All right, we're here with Fletcher Prouty, and it is now May 6, 1989, beginning a series of questions regarding his book published in 1973 by Prentice Hall called The Secret Team. One of the most essential parts of post-World War II American political action and agendas seemed to hinge on events that happened immediately after World War II. With the passage of the National Security Act of 1947, why don't you discuss the original intent of Congress of the role of the CIA as specified in this law?
It's very important in trying to discuss the National Security Act of 1947 to be sure that we go back into the spirit and the thinking of the time. We had just ended the greatest world war ever fought in late 1945, with the surrender of the Japanese on September 2nd, 1945. During early in 1946, President Truman abolished the OSS. There was no longer a need for an operating organization of that type now that the war was over. But there were assets of the OSS, primarily such things as agents, agents lists, who the agents worked with, and other activities like that that you just can't abandon. They have to be taken care of. And these were placed in an office which was concealed in the State Department for quite a while. And also, President Truman, by presidential directive, created the National Intelligence Group and placed it under General Vandenberg, Army officer, but later the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, who had a considerable experience with intelligence matters. Both of these acts by President Truman were more or less standby. He knew that there would have to be some change in the law to act on these intelligence matters. At that time also, you'll remember that the Soviet Union had been our ally during the war, was not a stated enemy as it became very shortly after that. So that the National Security Act of 1947, written, the language of the law, written during 1946, was based pretty much on the reality of World War II and not upon the Cold War realities. Now, for those of us looking back, that's kind of hard to think about because we have so ingrained in us now the fact that the Soviet Union is the enemy, communism is the enemy, and that the Germans and the Japanese and the Italians, who were our enemy in World War II, are all now friends. So you must go back into that era and begin there when you talk about the origins of CIA and the passage of this very important law, the National Security Act of 1947. Because I was teaching a major course, a year-long course at Yale called The Evolution of Warfare, I was very interested, of necessity interested, in these activities of 1946 and 47 as part of my course. So I read everything I could get from the congressional hearings, from the newspapers, everything that was going in those years toward the creation of this law, this new law. What you could see was some rather practical things, and then you could see some indications of things that were going to come. First of all, the Army and Navy had to share their aviation interests with a new branch of the service, the Air Force. That was one of the things that the public recognized about this new law. We created then a single Department of Defense. We hadn't had one. And many of the many of the officers that had fought World War II did not like this term Department of Defense. There's a very basic distinction, especially in warfare, but in athletics, in sports, in competition, between being on the offense and being on the defense. On the offense, you know what you're doing. On the offense, you're planning something. If you're on the offense with a Department of War, as we used to have, it doesn't mean you're planning to fight, but it means you're ready to fight, and you let everybody know that. If you're on the Department of Defense, You're waiting for somebody else to make a move, and then you react. The philosophy of the entire military structure of this country changed with this business of the Department of Defense. And coming as it did right when we were the most powerful nation in the world, with an enormous Army, Navy, and Air Force, and the nuclear weapon, which nobody else had in that period, to put all of that on the defense was an enormous oversight. And those of us who were close to all that felt it that way. There was no way to say that the World War II armies of the United States were to go on the defense. That destroyed, really, the structure of the Army. And a lot of people on active service felt that at that time. I say that because this business of the communist, anti-communist bit and the idea of a Department of War or Department of Navy as against Department of Defense, another major thing, was then joined by this new idea of a central intelligence agency. Now, one of the problems during World War II was not that we did not have enough intelligence. It was that it wasn't coordinated. The intelligence that General MacArthur and Admiral Nimitz had in the Pacific was not always coordinated with the intelligence that General Eisenhower and General Bradley and their allies had in the European theater. And a lot of times, Washington had different intelligence from different sources and didn't have the means to coordinate it properly for the overall benefit of our military forces who were fighting all over the world. And we had new ways of gathering intelligence. We had new electronic means. Radar was used to gather intelligence. We had aerial photography. We had all kinds of devices that were not in the ordinary James Bond intelligence of pre-war days. So the Congress understood from a lot of testimony from experienced military leaders that one of the greatest shortages and one of the greatest mistakes in the war was that we did not have coordinated intelligence. So when Congress wrote the language of this legislation for the CIA, and I printed this literally in the book so that anyone that wants to read it will see exactly what the law says. It said that the CIA is created to coordinate the intelligence of the rest of the government, and that was why it was created. With that as the primary duty of CIA, then the other little tasks and things that we're supposed to do come forward. Mm-hmm. And it's a better explanation. In fact, it is the only explanation when it is put that way. There was not a single word, for example, in the law that said that the CIA should collect intelligence. There wasn't a single word in the law that said the CIA should get involved in covert operations. And this is the same law that exists today, by the way. We haven't changed. But gradually things change, whether they're written into the law or not. But we're talking about the law of 1947, how it was written and what it meant. So that the people that first became members of this new CIA knew that their job was the coordination of intelligence. I had no doubt. The enormous move toward Cold War, anti-communism, and all that, all the buzzwords that we've lived on for the last 30 or 40 years, did not exist there, at least not strongly. It was coming over the horizon. While the National Security Act of 1947 was being written, primarily by men like the great lawyer Clark Clifford, a close friend of President Truman's, and an enormously influential man in this period, while that was being done, Churchill had made his speech in Missouri about the Iron Curtain and the Cold War and those things. The country was beginning to move in that direction. The era, the strange McCarthy era, had not come, but it was inevitable. It was on the way. What to do with the nuclear weapons was underway at the time. For instance, our military had never had a weapon as dynamic as the atom bomb. And what is important about an atom bomb, as it is with a barrel of oil, is it has no real value until it's been delivered. Well, the organization most able to deliver the atom bomb was the Air Force. And immediately, war planners saw that to use atom bombs, we would have to have an enormous fleet of very large aircraft. And one of the first thing they did was began to build a bigger and better B-29, which was the largest plane we had during the war, and finally even the B-36 and then the B-52 to carry the atom bomb. They needed an enormous plane to do that. It was a monster of a device in those days. Well, these things began to shape strategy. Then as they began to think about this, if atom bombs were going to be used as the primary weapon, how were you going to put a navy and an army into the battleground that atom bombs had devastated or could devastate, either way, because the enemy didn't have it. See, the enemy then, it used to be interesting, if you went to a military school in the 40s, you could talk about an enemy, but we were a Department of Defense. We weren't supposed to be talking about a particular enemy. And gradually, enemy became synonymous with Russia. And if we had opposing forces in a combat situation, we'd have the blue forces and the red forces. And we always knew we were the blue ones and that the Soviet. Gradually, this thinking came about. So while we were predominant with the nuclear weapon, it almost was ridiculous to think of any country as equal opposite force to ours. And that furthermore underscored the enormous mistake made in calling this military the Department of Defense, because if ever we were strong on the offense, it was immediately after World War II. We weren't a defensive nation at that time, but we were made a defensive nation by the Department of Defense. I haven't heard many people discuss that in so many words. I did in Yale when I was teaching. I used to talk about that a lot because I had hoped that was not really what was going to be the end of all this planning. Well, as the CIA started late in 47, it was primarily a rollover of World War II trained military people. The head of it was an admiral, Admiral Hillenkoetter. Mm-hmm. And I think out of the number that they had, over 5,000 were directly serving military people. They weren't reservists or anything. They were active duty people. And gradually, people from OSS and new recruitment began to fill up the agency. But that took years. That got into the Dulles era, Alan Dulles era, in the Eisenhower administration. During the late 40s, the number of civilians that rolled into the agency gradually was a relatively small number. I say relatively small with respect to, say, today. And among them, though, were some very strong OSS residual members who were well-trained in the side of covert work that involves clandestine operations. And despite the fact that that was totally overlooked in the law, even so much as to suppress that kind of activity by not putting it in the law and not creating a budget basis for that kind of expenditure of funds, the people with that training came into the CIA. Certainly the military wasn't going to get into that business, nor was the State Department. So it was a question of where do you keep this? So the residual OSS capability fell into the lap of the CIA. But even then, that took years. That didn't happen until General Walter Beadle Smith came home from Russia, where he had been ambassador to Russia, and became the director of Central Intelligence in, I believe, about 1950.
October of 1950.
And at that time, he brought Alan Dulles in as his deputy director of plans, which means in charge of covert operations. Well, Dulles had been with the OSS. And then he announced to the president that if he was going to be in charge, if he was going to be the director of Central Intelligence, he was going to have OPC under him and not scattered around with responsibilities in the State Department and the Defense Department. A lot has been said about OPC in the sense that how could such an organization have been created without law, and how was this ingenious little device of appointing its senior officer The way it read was that he would be nominated by one secretary, either state or defense, and having to be seconded by the other, and then would be approved, and as though he didn't have a single commander. Well, everybody knew that was temporary, and it had no real significance, because the real things that OPC was doing was to preserve certain assets, certain highly classified assets of World War II. He was not initiating operations. Now, I don't mean to say that disregarding some of the very practical things that were being done. For instance, we had clandestine operations underway in Greece as a result of the Greek Civil War right after the World War II, and these spilled over into Bulgaria and nearby countries across the Greek border. We had other operations going on in China, but relatively speaking, they were small, and they were, again, residuals of World War II. They were not planned operations as against some communist nation or that kind of thing. They were there, but they existed, and this was there. And the chief of OPC at the time was Frank Wisner, who had been a very dominant OSS leader in Eastern Europe during World War II, and later who led this massive campaign against Indonesia in 1958. So Wisner was very active in the covert activities. But when General Smith became the DCI, he insisted upon bringing that group into the agency. Now, strictly speaking, that was not supported by law. Uh-huh. It was sort of an expedient. One of the most important facets of this National Security Act of 1947 was the creation of the National Security Council. We had not had something like that in peacetime in other years, not under Roosevelt, and not before, and I don't even recall anything like that in World War I period. What was decided was that there are times when, for purposes of national security, there must be top-level decisions, and that the president needed assistance in making those decisions. So the National Security Council, by law, is the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, and the secretary of defense. No others. They can invite others, and others do attend the meetings, but there are no other statutory members. If we relate that to today's affairs, in all these questions about the Iran and Contra hearings and all those problems, there could not have been a decision about covert operations involving the Contras or Iran or exchange of hostages or any of that without a decision from the National Security Council. That's by law. There's no other way to do it other than an illegal way. And I don't think that's ever even been assumed, that there had to be decisions from the National Security Council. From my own experience and background, I just cannot believe that the members of the National Security Council during this Iran-Contra period have removed themselves from the whole thing as though they had nothing to do with it. That's preposterous. By law, they had to. If they didn't do it, they were derelict in their duty, and they should be tried for that. That's what the National Security Council was created to do. And in the 40s, the National Security Council met and created a directive which I believe is called 10/2. And 10/2 recognized that the U.S. government might from time to time be involved or involve itself in covert action. Generally, this would mean relatively small activities, not major warfare like the Korean War or the Vietnam War, that kind of thing, not even like the invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. I believe these were truly clandestine covert actions, and there were many of them. But later on, when I got into this business in the 50s, we had things like that going all the time, but they were small. Now, the decision to involve the United States in covert action had to be made by this National Security Council. No one else had the authority. And you see, that means even that the DCI, the head of the intelligence aid, was not part of the National Security Council. Therefore, he was not involved in the decision. He would be told about the decision. Well, during the 40s and the early 50s, things worked that way. In 1948, a rather important thing happened. President Truman wanted to have a highly qualified group study how the CIA was moving along, how it was progressing, and whether or not it was becoming effective. So he established a committee headed by Alan Dulles, who was a New York lawyer with the most prominent and largest law firm in New York City, Sullivan Cromwell, a man named Matthias Correia, who I believe also was a lawyer, although I don't recall his career that closely. His name, Correia, C-O-R-R-E-A, Matthias Correia, and then a man named Jackson. Jackson had a lot of experience, OSS experience. I think Correia did, and I certainly know that Dulles did. But anyway, this committee of three men, primarily Alan Dulles, made an extensive study of the activities of the CIA, and in their report to the president, recommended a move more into the clandestine operations area and more into the traditional intelligence area than the law had even visualized. Well, a very interesting thing about this committee, it was appointed by President Truman in his final year as president, as a successor to Roosevelt. See, Roosevelt died in 45, and he was the vice president, so he hadn't won an election yet, and he was going to run for re-election late 48 and then a new term beginning in 49. His opponent was Thomas E. Dewey. And interestingly, Thomas Dewey's speechwriter during the 1948 campaign against Truman was Alan Dulles. So you see, Dulles was riding two horses across this stream. He was technically Truman's advisor with respect to intelligence matters, he and Jackson and Correia. At the same time, he's writing speeches for Thomas E. Dewey, strongly opposing the re-election of Truman. I don't know whether Truman knew he was writing speeches for Dewey, or whether Dewey knew he was working for Truman. I mean, I have no way to solve that little problem. But it's pretty neat to understand the effect of that, and it helps you understand the mind of this man, Dulles. Dulles see nothing wrong in that sort of thing, you see. See nothing wrong in working for Truman and trying to undercut him by helping Dewey, or vice versa. Well, this had an influence on the report. Because, of course, Dulles, as was Jackson and Correia, were absolutely convinced, along with most of the country, that Dewey was going to be elected president. So as he wrote this report, he saw that report as, you might say, his own Mein Kampf. It was his own idea of what CIA was going to become, because he was positive that Dewey would make him the director of Central Intelligence when Dewey became president. See, and that designed the report. Well, as we know, Truman turned around and beat Dewey in a great surprise. And without much ado, the Dulles, Jackson, and Correia report was slid under the White House door on the 1st of January, 1949, and we never heard much of it after that. Although many of the things within the report did appear years later, because when Eisenhower became president, John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State. General Walter Beadle Smith became his deputy in the Secretary of State, stepped down from CIA, and Alan Dulles became the Director of Central Intelligence. Well, at that time, Dulles pulled out his own Dulles-Jackson-Correia report and began to put it in effect, and as you know, he remained the DCI for the next 11 years. Really, the signal primary character of the CIA is Mr. Dulles. There's no question about it. It's his agency, and nobody else has left any mark like his. But you need to see that background to understand what the passage of the National Security Act really meant in 1947, and what it says in law is what creates many of these controversies about intelligence today, because there still is no law that says that the CIA is an intelligence organization. It says it's a coordinating agent, and there's no law that says it is a covert operation agency. So that's a fairly good summary, as I've seen it through my own lifetime, of the law itself, the effect of the law, and then particularly how the CIA was an outgrowth of the law, and what the CIA was trying to do, and what the National Security Council was trying to do, and what the Congress was trying to do. And this eventually led to a remarkable statement by President Truman, I believe in December 1963, when he wrote as a columnist for a newspaper that the greatest mistake he made in his entire career as president was to sign the bill that created the Central Intelligence Agency.
Even though at the time it could be argued that he would not have seen the effect of his signing into law something which over time was changed by degree into something else.
Well, it's true that he never did sign the law that, I mean, the law he signed, if they had stayed within its parameters, the agency would have been much different. But he recognized that by setting this up, he initiated it.
I guess this perhaps is already explained by what you've just said, but perhaps just to comment briefly on this, you wrote on page 138 of The Secret Team that Congress had been so certain that the agency would not become operational and policy-making that it was content to place it under the control of a committee. Congress knew that the agency would never be permitted to become involved in clandestine operations, and therefore that the NSC would never have to direct it in an operational sense. How, at the time, do you feel Congress felt so unequivocal about this?
Well, you see, that's not a hard statement to understand. In the time of the 1940s, it is today in the 80s or in the 70s or in the 60s. In the late 1940s, Congress and the congressmen who were, many of them, veterans of World War II, knew very well that the United States government was not going to have a covert operation, a covert establishment running around the world, and they had not even created a new major intelligence organization. Congress, in other words, believed the words of the law that it had just written and passed. Furthermore, we weren't in the buzzword period or the Pavlovian period of anti-communism at that time. It was coming, but it didn't exist then.
Yeah.
And we were sitting on top of the atom bomb capability, which meant that we were the absolute power in the world. Things were so different in the late 40s that you can't take those statements without a lot of care and understanding and transpose them to either the 60s, the 70s, or 80s. It's just ridiculous. You have to read them in terms of the 40s. And that's a pretty true statement of the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, you'd change it if you were writing it today. And I'm sure Congress' view of CIA today is nothing like that, you see. But that is an important commentary on what has changed. And what has changed really in the people's minds, but not really in the language of the law. The law, the same law exists. But it's people's minds that have changed. It's our concept of the world that has changed. And that's a very important statement.
Mm-hmm. You do describe in fairly multitude of examples Alan Dulles' ability to, in effect, subvert the watchdog role of the NSC, which was intended to prevent such things as the CIA carrying out clandestine operations, by such moves as engineering the creation of such subcommittees as the Special Group 5412/2 that effectively neutralized such oversight functions as were intended to be carried out under the authority of the Operations Coordinating Board. Now, you've just mentioned how the OCB originally was set up to, in effect, have some supposed authority given to it by the Secretaries of Defense and State, and then how Walter Beadle Smith in late 1950, in a sense, regained that person's position as claiming it for himself, that person was directly under him. Can you explain somehow, particularly Dulles, who is so central to this, was able to redefine this watchdog role of the NSC over clandestine operations?
Okay, first of all, let me make a technical correction to your question. The OCB was the Operations Coordinating Board, which was a part of NSC by law. OCB was intended to be a group of senior individuals, or it was a group of senior individuals who would follow the decisions made by the National Security Council and make sure that the bureaucracy carried them out. That was the function of the OCB, a different organization. The operations policy, OPC, the Operations Policy Committee,
right,
was the residual OSS organization that was under Frank Wisner, and an extremely distinct organization from OCB.
Okay.
The OPC had been created only without law. See, it came from World War II. It was a necessary function. It was like sweeping up things left on the floor after the war. We had to keep alive the records from the OSS, and it was agreed to put this organization only structurally within the State Department, but to control its chief by making the new Secretary of Defense and his counterpart, the Secretary of State, responsible for the leader of the organization, giving him some control that way. The budgetary function was minimal. It was just a matter of paying people, that's about all, and taking care of the records. A lot of people have misinterpreted the OPC, although when it gradually worked its way into the CIA under Beadle Smith, it did become dominant again. It became rather strong, and it became the main clandestine operations sector of the agency later, known as the Deputy Director of Plans, and that sort of thing. So I like to correct the two letters are somewhat similar, but the jobs are entirely different. Now, we'll go back to Mr. Dulles and how he was able to circumvent the law. And really, the best way is to say again that the report that he had written with Correa and with Jackson outlined his vision of how the CIA ought to be. He believed that. He thought that it ought to have a full intelligence powers, including secret intelligence, and that it ought to have the clandestine capability to carry out any operations directed by the National Security Council. Well, by the time, see, he thought that could be started in 49. But by the time he got to be the DCI, things hadn't worked that way. The CIA had been kept rather quiet. It was coordinating intelligence, and it was doing very little in the covert activities field. He felt that should change, but he didn't have any law to do it. So what he did is he would take a plan that they had made up because of some input from a foreign country or from one of his station chiefs around the world that was in response to some action. Well, then he'd go to the National Security Council. They didn't direct him to go to X country and do something. They were approving something that he felt he ought to do in response to an action that some of his operators, some of his agents had seen in a foreign country. And that device enabled him to create activities as though they were reaction, and most of the time they were, or responses. And so the NSC found itself not directing covert operations, but approving reactive covert operations. There's quite a bit of difference. But when you're doing that with an organization like the CIA, under an ambitious leader like Alan Dulles, it's pretty hard to tell the difference, because sometimes you can create a response by kicking somebody under the table and they pound you in the nose, then you point to your partner and say, look at that guy, just hit me. Mm-hmm. You didn't know you kicked him under the table. The best example, the absolute best example I know of that tactic was the Gulf of Tonkin incident. The Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese that came out in the vicinity of the destroyers, which the Navy now admits were never even hit by anything fired at them, probably not even fired at. But the why those North Vietnamese Komar ships, very high-speed ships, came out there was because they had been hit clandestinely. So that the first act was by our own forces, aided with South Vietnamese. Then when the North Vietnamese came out, they had been provoked. They did not initiate the attack. But in the discussion of that, both by President Johnson and in Congress, when they were discussing the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, they were only told that the attack had been made by the North Vietnamese upon our Navy without provocation. Mm-hmm. So you can control covert activities by using that same device, the kick under the table, and then you can say, hey, now look what happened in the Congo, or look what happened in Indonesia, or look what happened in Tibet. We've got to do something about it. This was the technique that Dulles was the master of working at, and he tried to have the agency ready to be responsive anywhere in the world. And of course he had to do it that way because there were no plans. They didn't sit here and say, well, here's what we see happening in such and such a country, and here's what we think ought to be done, and here's how the United States should get in there with a covert operation to perform this or that. You know, there was none of that. There was no planning shop. In fact, I've always thought, and I worked very closely with them, that one of the strangest devices they used was to call their covert operations the deputy director plans, because there were no plans. I worked with them intimately for 9 years. I never saw a single plan come out of the deputy director plans. And of course, they would simply smile and say, well, that's just our euphemism for covert operations. But it was they could have used some other word than plan, because that was... But this is how Dulles worked, you see, and he was very effective. And he had had a lot of experience with OSS. And the other side of it is that his brother was the Secretary of State and the dominant vote in the National Security Council. I don't think this would have been the same if he had been an individual with, say, some either neutral or objective Secretary of State. It made quite a bit of difference under the Eisenhower era to have the two Dulles working together in the development of covert operations.
Mm-hmm. And therefore, then, this key revising of the word as specified in the law that the NSC would direct the CIA, and now that the agency was in effect to turn this into the NSC approving measures brought to it by the CIA.
Precisely. See, I remember one example out of 9 years' work when I knew that the NSC had directed the CIA to involve itself in something, and that was Tibet. When the Chinese communists started overrunning Tibet, it was the NSC that put the CIA into that operation. And I must confess that in all those years, 55 to 64, pretty active years, I never saw another one come by direction. They were all responsive and reactive operations to things where Mr. Dulles or people that followed him would go in to brief the NSC from their own papers and say, here's what's been happening in country A, we propose an operation to oppose that. That's why we got into what was called counterinsurgency. We countered the insurgency. Yeah. Almost everything we were doing was a reactive response. But that was the Dulles method. That was his characteristic.
I'd like to quote a part here regarding the intelligence community as a whole. You wrote that on page 141 of The Secret Team, over the years it has become customary to speak of the various intelligence organizations within the government as members of the community. This word is quite proper because there is little cohesion and homogeneity within this vast infrastructure, which has cost so much and which performs so many varied and separate functions. The members of the community are the CIA, the Army, Navy, and Air Force as separate divisions, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the FBI, the Atomic Energy Commission, the State Department, and the National Security Agency. All are by law brought together by the Director of Central Intelligence, or DCI. His title is not the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, although he does head that agency for the purpose of advising the NSC in matters concerning such intelligence activities of the government departments and agencies as relate to national security. That's directly from the National Security Act of 1947. This is the DCI's first duty as prescribed by law. He is to advise the NSC of the activities of the other departments and agencies. Could you discuss the importance of the fact that all of the above-listed members of the intelligence community, quote, are by law brought together by the Director of Central Intelligence, unquote, and the implications of such an all-encompassing position?
That's a good section to bring out for discussion, because the law established, created, didn't establish. Established means something else in government. The law created the CIA to coordinate intelligence of the other branch of the government, as I listed them there. And the law specifically deals with the function of the Director of Central Intelligence. He is different from his organization. He is the Director of Intelligence over the other intelligence organizations within the scope of the law that establish him. He's not their boss in a sense that the Navy intelligence operates for the CNO, for the Chief of Navy, but as far as intelligence matters are concerned, and as far as coordinating intelligence matters, he's the Director for the coordinating purposes. It's quite a clear distinction, but you can see it does get waffled around. And certain of the intelligence assets of various departments, we'll say the Navy, are very independent. The Navy's intelligence organization goes way back to Revolutionary War days. They are an excellent professional organization, and they're worldwide, and they're very powerful and very able. They were not subverting themselves to any new boss. They knew their job, and they made that clear when the law was being written. In fact, they protested the law more than anybody else. The Army has its own black intelligence, very deep intelligence, in many ways deeper than the CIA has ever learned how to do. They were not going to fold that into the CIA either. The Air Force was brand new, excuse me, had no intelligence other than experience as part of the Army. However, the Air Force had the aircraft, the U-2, the SR-71, the bombers and the camera plane, all the reconnaissance planes. They had the methods of intelligence that they could use that the DCI needed for coordinating also. So the Air Force, although it was new, in some ways, was probably more important than the other branches. So you see, what I'm saying is that this intelligence community, which the law was created to bring together, was not homogenous, but they were essential to each other. No more than, say, the National Security Agency. Just think what any of these would be without the National Security Agency. They all depend upon the National Security Agency for the intercept of electronic transmission and all the other things, communications intelligence and all the rest. Well, the National Security Agency is a function of the Department of Defense. In fact, the office where I used to be assigned was responsible for directing the National Security Agency in order that we could coordinate it with state and CIA and the others ourselves to make sure it was effective. A very nice way to do this thing, and it was important in those days. So there is an intelligence community of great importance and great significance to each one of its components. But the sole chief of that community by law is the Director of Central Intelligence in the role that he's coordinating. No more than that. He doesn't direct these people in a clandestine exercise, not at all. Then he's the Director of Central, then he is the head of the CIA, and then he carries out things that are assigned to the CIA. So I'm sorry, it's quite clear how that works, although I'm afraid historically there are many, many abuses and a lot of times oversights in that, primarily because many of these agencies and departments have very parochial interests of their own, and it's pretty hard for anybody to coordinate them.
Mm-hmm. You, in the law for powers and duties under National Security Act, Section 3, it says to correlate and evaluate intelligence relating to the national security. What about, just going through very briefly, examining or discussing the stated or explicit role of each of these members, as well as any important unstated roles that they carry out today? Let's start out with the CIA, at least in terms of the way it should work, which may vary a lot from the way it does.
You know, that's a excellent way to put the question, because it's impossible to answer that. You see, as we've been talking about, the law was written in 46 and 47 at an era that we cannot duplicate today at all. So I would just say right off that it would be futile to try to enforce the law literally on either the Defense Department or the CIA. There's no way you could, or the State Department. Mm-hmm. However, you have to abide by the law, see? And so you, at that point, you begin to let, you might say, the law of custom step in. What have we been doing? What have we accepted? So today, I don't think you could ever press back into the bottle what was decided in 46 and 47 and say, that's what the CIA is going to do. There's just no way you could do that. And I don't know how to prescribe for the CIA what it ought to be doing today by thinking about the law. But there's one part of the law that can take care of this, and this was one of the really beautiful things about that law, and that is that no matter what the CIA wants to do or tries to do or is funded to do, a very important statement of that, funded to do, because Congress permits the CIA to do an awful lot by pouring money into the CIA. If you got money, you're going to spend it. You know, Parkinson's law. If you build an office and you put a man in the office, he's going to go to work whether you tell him or not. So you fund CIA and you're going to get things done. Well, in the present time, under that situation, this emphasizes the great significance of the National Security Council.